Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, where we're exploring the different cultural experiences of consciousness and their effects on basically our reality as human beings. Today we're very excited to be talking about one of the purveyors of consciousness studies who had a really big effect on their influence on society in a lot of different ways, extending into many different aspects of culture in multiple countries around the world, the notorious Carl Jung. And Carl Jung, of course, has been in the forefront of a lot of people's minds lately since his new book, The Red Book, came out. And if any of you guys have had a chance to take a look at The Red Book, it's pretty amazing. There's really not much about The Red Book that isn't amazing, and it basically covers a diary of Carl Jung's dream experiences and some of his own private explorations into his different states of consciousness and exploring some of their mystical and esoteric significance. And Carl Jung, of course, became famous for studying psychology, and a lot of the controversy surrounding him was due to his breakup with Sigmund Freud and kind of how that split the study of psychology into two different worlds, one being that there are biological causes for any kind of psychological situation, and that was on the Sigmund Freud end, and then the other one, of course, being that there might be spiritual causes for mental malaise, and Carl Jung was a person that kind of started exploring those things. And he did receive a fair amount of persecution from Sigmund Freud himself, because Sigmund thought he was a little too woo-woo, a little getting new agey, getting out of the scientific side of things and into things that were a little too fringy and far-flung. But then eventually, you know, Carl Jung tried to fight that and say he was a scientist and all that, but then became more secure in his ability to say that he had mystical experiences and things that he couldn't understand. And today we're going to be talking with someone who has just put out a book which talks about just that, the kind of mystical side of Carl Jung. And we're very excited to have Gary Lachman on the show today. His latest book, Jung the Mystic, The Esoteric Dimension of Carl Jung's Life and Teachings, which has come out. I encourage you all to take a look at it because it covers a lot of these ideas that a lot of people don't really want to mention. Surprisingly, even some Jungians get a little uncomfortable when you mention it. Gary, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've been a big fan.
Hello, guys. I just want to interrupt. I'm sorry, I had a little technical difficulty getting on, so I also want to welcome Gary onto the show.
Oh, good. Eric's back. Yeah, he's
back. Hi, Eric. Well, thanks for being on, Eric.
Absolutely, of course.
Eric, what do you think about Carl Jung?
I don't know. I just read this great book by Gary Lachman. No, I'm really, really happy to have Gary on the show. I think he's one of the best writers on esoteric topics today. He writes very intelligent but very accessible and fun books that that are balanced and also open to the mysteries that lie within some of his amazing characters. And I'm just kind of curious. You've done a number of sort of biographies or biographical studies of people at this particular time in history who were exploring spirituality, early 20th century modern period. What is it about this time when Jung is also coming into his own that so intrigues you, Gary?
Well, I've always been interested in that period, even before I got interested in sort of the esoteric stuff that was happening then. But I think it's this sort of time. If you take from like the late 19th century when the Theosophical movement was getting going and becoming this worldwide phenomena, until about, I would say, in between the two world wars. That's when you get kind of, you know, the sort of basic foundation work in what we would consider, I guess, modern esotericism or modern spirituality. You have, you know, you have Blavatsky, then you have people like Rudolf Steiner, you've got Gurdjieff and Uspensky, you've got Jung starting up in there, and many others as well around that time. And it's just a fascinating period for me, and I always think of that early 20th century, say from about the fin de siècle, say from about 1890 up until World War One, as this kind of missed chance in a way. It was kind of the modern world phase one, in which a lot of these ideas came together. I mean, we tend to think of the New Age or something along those lines as something that started going, you know, like the late 60s into the 70s, but many of the same ideas that became really popular and were disseminated worldwide in that period were around in that time, this sort of 1890s up into about 1913 or 14. I've just always found it fascinating. And then sadly, World War One happened, and this kind of sort of optimistic modernism that blended together theosophical ideas with progressive political ideas and a variety of other different things sort of got, you know, wiped out by World War One. So it always struck me as a kind of a missed chance.
Do you think it was a missed chance?
I've always just found it a very fascinating time.
Do you think it was a missed chance, or do you think there was some kind of connection to that uprising and then the start of World War One?
Well, I mean, a missed chance in the way that, you know, it looked like the modernity didn't quite have the character of it that we feel today as sort of a threat, or there's a problem, or there's something suspicious about it. There was a progressive notion to the modern that also linked with a lot of metaphysical or spiritual sorts of ideas. Just take theosophy. Someone like Annie Besant, you know, who was a socialist and a suffragette and all of that, and then became, you know, head of the Theosophical Society, and then was also involved with the Indian liberation movement and all that. It always struck me as just a really fantastic sort of blend of different sorts of things. You could mix vegetarianism with sort of dress reform with, you know, some other ideas, and it didn't seem very strange.
One of the things that really interests me about this period of time and a lot of the other figures you've written about, Rudolf Steiner, Gurdjieff, is that they also weave their way into 20th century culture in very interesting ways. It's not that they're just quote-unquote spiritual figures off in the corner where only people who are interested in mysticism or esotericism are showing up. It's that you kind of peel back the layers on modern culture and you realize that they're thoroughly interwoven there, and probably no more so than Jung, who himself straddled the line between the mystic, as you reveal, and a more secular, scientific approach that fed directly into the psychological obsessions of the 20th century.
Mm. No, I think you're right. I think today it's all kind of neatly packaged in sort of genres, and you know, there's that section on this particular kind of teaching and so on and so on. But no, you're absolutely right. You go back, and you know, artists and writers and poets and philosophers and scientists and others were all sort of, you know, cheek by jowl with mystics and gurus and spiritualists, and you know, some of the most famous people in the world, people like William James, the American philosopher and psychologist, was, you know, a very well respected academic figure, but he was also an outspoken proponent of studying what we would call parapsychology. Henri Bergson, the French philosopher, was another one. People like Thomas Edison, you know, he wanted to invent this kind of spirit phone to be able to record, you know, the messages from the spirit world and all that. So it's a surprisingly sort of open time, and I think it grasps that that essence of modernity, which was the sense of, or one aspect of it, the sense of, you know, newness of trying to try new things and open new ground and follow new paths and sort of drop away from convention. So no, I think you're absolutely right. That's another thing that fascinates me, because I'm equally interested in art and culture and philosophy and literature and all that, and I love when these two sort of things, you know, come together.
I really like about the stuff that you cover in the book is just that how, you know, Jung kind of wrestled with that idea of finally coming into his own with it, which happens to so many other, you know, prominent figures that do that. They receive quite a bit of ridicule. I mean, you can look at the problem with accepting the fact that science and mysticism can exist side by side. You know, you can look at Isaac Newton or Niels Bohr or Nikola Tesla and all these kind of, and people that you mentioned too. And then there's a fascination with it, but then also like a backlash, which Jung definitely received himself. And just that, you know, there is that it's almost essential to have these groundbreaking modernity movements happen that need that kind of fusion of science and mysticism.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think that I've sort of made this point in a couple different books. I think since about the 1600s, you know, what had hitherto been a very prestigious and well-respected pursuit, you know, the hermetic sciences.
Yeah.
You mentioned Newton, obviously, and other people like him. It goes underground.
Yeah.
Around the time of the Rosicrucians and the rise of science, and I think ever since it's been this sort of reservoir of James Webb, historian of the occult, in the 70s called rejected knowledge. It's this sort of arsenal that different poets and writers and thinkers who are dissatisfied with the hyper scientistic, hyper rational, mechanistic view that came into dominance and is still dominant today. I mean, I don't know if the news got over there, but over here the big thing on some of the headlines in newspapers is the fact that Stephen Hawking, you know, has said that, God doesn't fit into my calculations. So
I know.
But to me, what's funny about that is that, like, I'm nothing against Stephen Hawking, but why do you have to keep sort of, isn't that a dead horse? I mean, didn't people say that already 200 years ago, 300 years ago? Why do they have to keep, you know, bringing it up and sort of making it official in different ways? And I mean, the answer to that isn't some brainless fundamentalist, you know, talking about, you know, seeing the Bible as accurate scientific fact and all that. I mean, the sad thing is in the media, these things are, you know, fluctuate between the two poles.
But
it's curious to me that you have to somehow, there's some itch to keep going back and reaffirm this sense that nope, there's nothing spiritual out there, there's nothing like that at all. And to me, that suggests that, you know, it's working in the shadows. It's there.
It's a testament to Stephen Hawking's ignorance that he could possibly say anything 100% when he's a scientist and he understands that there's nothing you can say that's 100% verifiable. For him to make statements like that just belies his own ignorance. So.
I think the funny thing is he also recently said something about aliens, you know, that we shouldn't look for them because they'll come and eat us or something like that. Now, he didn't get ridiculed for that, right?
Not at all. In fact, people were very excited.
I mean, he sort of said that and it kind of got, you know, it was in the news for a bit and then it sort of faded away, but it's the sort of thing that, you know, lots of people have said that, but because he's a scientist, you know, and again, I have nothing against him personally, you know, he's a scientist that it gets credited, but I think with someone like Jung, I mean, there's a lot of factors involved in his kind of ambivalent, you know, yes-no kind of relationship with mysticism and the occult and all that. I mean, I think you can't rule out his own prudent sense of his career. You know, he didn't want to be sort of left out of the whole of the science, as it were. But at the same time, you know, he had enough sort of honesty and you know, real sense of the reality of these sorts of things that get called mystical or supernatural, that he couldn't, you know, completely sort of jettison it. So he wrestled with that, you know, throughout his career until about the mid 40s when he had his near death experience and he decided, well, you know, I should maybe, you know, not be quite so adamant about this.
We'll talk a little bit also about how his experiences sort of fed into his practices, particularly the idea of active imagination, which is so important to certain wings of the sort of Jungian movement, if you will. And a lot of his ideas, a lot of his principal ideas, as you talk about, emerged from a kind of intense experience that had a lot of supernatural or at least paranormal dimensions to it. Can you just give us a little brief slice of that?
Well, I mean, Maya mentioned the Red Book, and basically the Red Book is Jung's account of his going crazy. If you want to speak of it in that way. I mean, it's this journal of all these visions and in waking dreams and trance states and encounters with people living inside his head. And it was out of that sort of turmoil. He went through, I guess you could call it the mother of all nervous breakdowns and midlife crises after his, the rupture with Freud. It was through that he basically figured out a way to save himself from going mad, which was to actively engage with the visions and waking dreams and hallucinations, quote unquote, that he was experiencing, instead of trying to resist them or push them away or somehow avoid them. And this became what he later called active imagination. But again, I mean, Jung, he never really comes out. There isn't like the book by Jung about active imagination. It's peppered. I mean, his writings are peppered with it here and there. And the most clear sort of statement about it is in a essay he wrote called The Transcendent Function, which deals with a related theme to active imagination. This he wrote in 1916, in the middle of this crisis when he was actively involved in these sorts of things, but he hid it away. He didn't publish it until decades later, and then was only in a small sort of student's sort of newsletter. It was something that he talked about with his closest colleagues and some of his patients, but he didn't really own up about it and then come out and out front about it. And you can think that, well, this is understandable, because he already had Freud and the people in Freud's circle calling him a mystic and all of that. I mean, that started around 1912 when Jung was publishing Symbols of Transformation. It's the book that sort of marks his break with Freud, where he's basically rejecting the sexual theory and saying that, well, it can't account for everything. And at that point, Freud was already sort of getting very worried about Jung. What would people think if he's admitting that he's talking to people inside his head? So it's a strange sort of thing. I mean, I don't have a problem with recognizing that in a way Jung allowed himself to, as we would term it, go crazy, because it was like going through that hell.
This is something very interesting to me, and I don't know, maybe you have some insight into it in the research that you did. There was a fellow before Jung who was very close with Freud named Herbert Silberer.
Oh, yeah, Silberer,
who wrote
a
book called The Problems of Mysticism, and he was really kind of the first person to sync up the alchemical research with psychological issues. I mean, in modern times, and he presented his work to Freud and got that one book published, which now I think is republished as The Hidden Symbolism of Alchemy and the Occult. But after he presented it to Freud, Freud basically did the same thing to him that he did to Jung later, which was to say he was crazy and a mystic. And then Herbert Silberer did go crazy, much like Jung's experience in the Red Book, but he ended up committing suicide.
Yeah, he committed suicide.
Unlike Jung, he was not able to come out the other end and integrate it like Jung did. And I was just curious, just having that, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's the sort of thing. I think Jung himself, I think, was an incredibly strong person. He's sort of bull-like. He's ox-like. I mean, he's physically strong. And then he himself says in Memories, Dreams, and Reflections that he knew that others before him had been shattered by these experiences. He mentions the German poet Hölderlin and the philosopher Nietzsche. And, they had been buffeted by, the winds of the archetypes, before him. But he kept himself sane by saying, I am Herr Dr. Jung. I have a wife and five children. I have a practice here in Zurich, and he basically was strong enough to sort of withstand it. I mean, Silberer, I don't know too much about him in his personal life, but he hung himself in a really rather macabre way. I mean, he arranged a light to be shining in his face so that when his wife walked in, it was the first thing she would see. Was him hanging. So it's pretty horrible. But Freud had this strange effect on the people who were in his sort of inner circle. Victor Tausk was another one who was driven to suicide by being sort of ejected from Freud's circle. Wilhelm Reich was another one who went through a nervous breakdown after Freud refused to psychoanalyze him.
Yeah, there was like a whole
Reich system. Came through it and developed his own system. He later, you know, more or less went off the deep end, I think. But Jung somehow had this, you know, he's a bull-like, really powerful, earthy, you know, firmly rooted kind of character. So I think he was just personally strong enough to withstand this sort of psychic turmoil he went through and come out the other side.
Raises an interesting question, which is that do you think that kind of therapeutic approach beyond its sort of psychological validity for people who are interested in exploring themselves or in integrating themselves, you know, in terms of their normal, the sort of normal run of neuroses, but can you see that actually working with madness? I mean, was it just sort of unique to Jung's personality that he was able to confront madness and go through it, or does it seem to you from, you know, your readings and studies whether that's actually a way, that there's a way to engage the creatures of the unleashed, uncorked unconsciousness in this way that you can actually create something coherent out of it?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think Jung himself said you have to have a very sort of strong ego to be able to sort of do this. In many ways, the people that he would advise, you know, practicing something like active imagination were people that they weren't suffering from sort of mental illness so much as a sense of kind of emptiness and meaninglessness in their life. And this was a way that Jung felt that he himself had arrived at his own myth, his own sense of meaning. And so I assume he felt that, you know, these others could do that too. But I think you have to watch it because, in a book I wrote about the 60s, Turn Off Your Mind, this is precisely a theme that I explore. I mean, like, okay, well, you know, there's this idea that, you know, just getting rid of all repression and letting the unconscious rip, this is the way to, you know, liberation and freedom in the golden age. Well, it didn't really, at least for me, it didn't really work that way. And you look at somebody like R.D. Lang, who promoted an idea much like Jung's in the sense of, like, taking the madness seriously and letting the madness happen. It didn't really achieve the kind of results that I think Lang wanted. And Lang himself, in many ways, you know, went down the road of excess and you know, became alcoholic and so on. So, I, again, in a way, it sort of argues for a kind of elite. You know, you have to be sort of physically and also mentally strong enough to sort of withstand, you know, the siren song, as it were, in order to get, you know, to get past and carry on the journey. If you're not, you're basically sort of asking for a lot of trouble. So I think in many ways this is why Jung kept it a secret, as it were, you know, for only his closest sort of followers and patients. Because you could see where someone with a more fragile ego, a more fragile hold on their own psyche, basically inviting these encounters with the unconscious and not being able to deal with it. I mean, this is what he argued that people like Nietzsche, this is what happened to people like Nietzsche and Hölderlin. They weren't secure enough in the world. You know, they were like these sort of, they kind of fluttered through life. And you know, Nietzsche himself, you know, went from town to town. He didn't have, you know, a real family or friends or anything like that. He was totally on his own. So it's understandable that he would, you know, sort of at times just be overwhelmed by these sorts of things.
Well, and to me, one of the most miraculous things about what you're saying is that Jung, apart from many of these other folks who just couldn't quite make it through the madness, Jung was able to have that strength of ego to do it, and then goes on to become a midwife kind of for other people going through this thing, and then he becomes this kind of guiding, you know, like you said, very earthy anchor for people that are, and he gets drawn into, you know, his work is basically treating people going through the same thing. But he only understood it basically because he went into the madness himself, and that's why I've always thought that Jung is a total shaman.
Oh yeah, no, I think that's you. I think he's the proverbial wounded healer. You know,
totally.
He's the one who,
totally.
I mean, unlike someone like Freud, or Freud would admit that he has, I have a bit of neuroses here and there, and yes, I'm superstitious about that. But he pretty much, kept a grip on things and, you know, didn't want to sort of let go of his sort of rational hold on things. And, Jung himself said he had to fight. He had to fight with himself to allow this to happen.
Right.
Because one side of him was, you know, he hated the whole idea of fantasy. He wanted to, you know, he was a scientist. Everything, you know, must, all this must in Ordnung sein. Everything must be, you know, in order and all that. And the idea of letting this fantasy just sort of go on its own and following it, not judging it, was something that he really had to learn how to do. But I think you're absolutely right. You know, Jung had this remarkable ability to get people to see themselves in a better way. I mean, so many people who came to him that later became Jungian therapists came to him because they were completely troubled. And he, some people like Tony Wolf and Sabina Spielrein and others like that, they had a horrible sense of themselves. And he somehow was able to show them that they were more than they thought they were in some way. So I think you're absolutely right. He was this strong kind of, you know, pillar and around on which people could sort of, you know, hold on when, you know, were being sort of buffeted by the madness around him.
Well, one of the things I think is so valuable about his story, and particularly the way you tell it, is that it shows, you know, one person's attempt to cross that line that we talked about at the beginning, and that, you know, in many ways is sort of the one of the overarching themes of this show, is how to simultaneously be a modern person in a world of science and you know, individual rationality, and to open yourself to these other domains and to the meaning that comes through it, whether it's through from artistic experience or the deepening of the self. And that, you know, he really wrestled with it in this really fascinating way, obscuring it in some ways. That's part of the obscurity of his writings. You know, a lot of people might turn to Jung and be like, okay, here, I'm going to get something. They're like, wow, it's pretty gnarly, you know. And I don't think it's just that he's a quote unquote bad writer, because there's some parts where he's extremely lucid, but it's almost more that he himself hasn't quite figured out how to you know, be true to both sides of himself. And so that makes me wonder, like, why is it happening now? Like, the Red Book is this expensive book by this, you know, that looks very beautiful, sure, but it's, by a psychologist who, from most perspectives, is somewhat discredited. You know, all the cognitive science people and all the people, you know, prescribing psychopharmaceuticals, they don't care about you, they don't care about Freud. And then, and yet, this book is incredibly, bizarrely a bestseller, a hit. What is it about the mystic Jung, the figure of the mystic Jung, that's attractive now, I wonder?
Well, I think, for one thing, to a great degree, it's the very fact that, you know, the Red Book has this history of being locked away in a cupboard and then in a Swiss bank vault, and no one's seen it, a handful of people, and so on and so on, and it was this sort of, you know, great lost work that finally came out. So I think a lot of people bought it. I mean, the fact that the New York Times devoted this huge, you know, article to it was in itself breathtaking, because New York Times was, as far as I know, was never particularly, you know, partial to Jung. You know, he's considered it, you know, this flaky, mystical sort of stuff. And so the fact that they devoted so much, you know, column space to the publication of the book is something itself that's remarkable. But I think Jung he's at the back of so much of what people in the spiritual community, or the New Age community, or the esoteric community, whatever you want to call it, the alternative community, so much of what they sort of take as read, you know, as kind of the beginning. And it's one of the things that I found doing the book, was that even though I knew this, it was like, just like, my God, I didn't realize, yeah, he's like sort of there, you know, he's like the one who's, he's introducing, you know, the books of the East, the I Ching, books on Zen Buddhism, books on Hinduism, on Taoism and Chinese alchemy, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, all these sorts of things that, this is in the 40s, you know, and 50s and so on, that, you know, became mainstays of New Age spiritual thought later on. So I think in a way it's I want to avoid using the sort of term founding father too much, but I think in many ways, you know, he was this kind of founding father of, I don't know what you want to call it, the alternative spiritual, you know, movement. And it's important to go back and sort of reacquaint yourself with those ideas, those foundational ideas, and to understand their importance. And again, also, you know, Jung was a man like anybody else. He made mistakes. You know, he had an ornery side that came out in his personal relationships, and I think also in his sort of intellectual relationships and all that. So I think he's one of these people that, I mean, for me, it's this is what I enjoy doing. You know, doing the book on him, doing the book on Steiner and on Swedenborg. I'm about to start one on Madame Blavatsky. It's sort of going back into them and saying, okay, you know, let's look at them in a new way. Let's look at them in a fresh way. Not just repackage them, but try to understand them, because I come from a generation that I feel inherited both the sort of mainstream Western, you know, intellectual kind of tradition and this other esoteric sort of tradition. And to me, I mean, I don't want to sort of make too fine a point about it, but what I think what I've been trying to do is kind of, you know, bring those two things, make it part of the conversation. You know, don't have them polarized. Make them part of the general conversation about who we are now in, you know, the early days of the 21st century. So I think it's important to go back to these foundational figures and sort of reacquaint yourself with them.
Sure. I also want to ask a little bit more about your background, but before we do, I want to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. We're talking with Gary Lachman, and we'll be right back after these messages.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, this is Dr. Meir Eisenstein. Listen to me every Monday evening at 7 p.m. I'm going to explain to you how less medicine, less pharmaceuticals, less vaccines may actually make you healthier. I'll be live. It'll be a call-in every Monday night at 7 p.m. Please come and join me.
So join in on the conversation at 888-874-4888 every Monday at 7 with Dr. Eisenstein.
A shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hi, I'm Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew, which airs on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. My show interviews fascinating authors, inventors, and researchers of new understandings, techniques, and discoveries that can enhance and transform our lives. What is our potential and how can we fulfill it to the max? To find out, tune into Energy Stew and Peter Roth at 8 p.m. Thursdays on Progressive Radio Network.
listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m. Please join us as we connect people, ideas, important information, and discover solutions to some of the most urgent problems facing us. Every Thursday, 5 to 6 p.m., Community Currency on Progressive Radio Network.
Listen to Of Consuming Interest every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Jim Turner, attorney in Washington, D.C., chairman of the Board of Citizens for Health. Every Friday from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, we discuss a topic of consuming interest, often about health, but also about politics, commerce, and whatever the current topic of the day might be. Of Consuming Interest, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, on the Progressive Radio Network.
I'm Steve Barnett. I'm your host for the Paradise Parking Lot, an environmental program on the Progressive Radio Network. We're on the air from 1 to 2 Eastern Time every Wednesday, and we talk about everything environmental. This is an hour show, so there are no sound bites. This is a deep discussion of controversial environmental issues. We provide information. We provide guides to action. We have wonderful guests. For example, we've had John Holdren, President Obama's science advisor. We've had Jaron Lanier, the creator of virtual reality. This program is designed for anyone who's interested in the environment and deepening their understanding of how our planet is changing and what we can do about it.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Mazza Dawu. We're here with Eric Davis, and today we're talking with Gary Lockman, author of many fine books, and many people might or might not know, rock and roll genius. Gary, you were talking before the break about some of your other biographies, and I just really wanted to mention that, you know, a lot of these people that you choose to write biographies on, it's really interesting because you get either one or two different versions of their stories. One are totally idolatrous, where it's from people who are literally followers of these people and hold them up to such high regard, or other people that try to totally break them apart. And, like, you had mentioned Sabina before, and I know there was that book on Carl Jung, The Jung Cult, by Richard Knoll, which of course, very just harping on his fidelity issues and some of his sexual indiscretions and things that he dealt with like that. And it seems like, especially with Jung, you get people who try to, you know, take apart any meaning from his work due to things that might have happened. And one of the things I like with books like yours is that they integrate those things into the person as a totality, which of course is very Jungian. And I think that for all of these people, if people can stop eradicating the shadows of these people as taboo, which literally the Red Book was kept as taboo, not able for people to see for so long, but that rather these people become, even to me, stronger, more amazing people when their shadows are considered and integrated into what they do, and you can see how they make up the realizations that these people have. And I just really appreciate your view on not eradicating these parts of them, but rather looking at how they play into their lives.
I'm glad that you appreciate that. I mean, to me, it doesn't make any sense, you know, writing a book that's either going to be a hagiography where, you know, whoever it is, Swedenborg, Jung, Steiner, Gurdjieff, they can do no wrong, or the opposite, where you just spend, you know, pages and pages trying to debunk them. I mean, to me, what's important is trying to understand. And as I said earlier, I mean, Jung and like the others, you know, they're human beings, they have flaws, they have faults, you know, they pick their noses or whatever, so, and, you know, you just have to accept that. What I tried to do in the Jung book and in all the others is to, you know, find a balance between the two things. I mean, I think I'm sympathetic but critical. I mean,
right.
I don't consider myself a Jungian or an anthroposophist or a Swedenborgian, but there's certainly enough important ideas with all of them to pursue and try and understand. And I think with someone like Jung, you do get some, the Richard Noll book is one case in point. There's another huge biography by a writer named Ronald Heyman, which is very readable. It's one of the most readable books about Jung, but he just, you know, you can just tell from page one, he just doesn't like the guy.
Yeah.
And he sort of is always going out of his way to sort of highlight disreputable aspects about himself. And Jung himself would be the first one, you know, to say that, you know, of course, you know, I have a shadow, so is everybody else, and you're only fooling yourself if you try to avoid recognizing it. And Jung didn't want he didn't want any Jungians around him.
Right.
So what happens is with the Jungians and the Steinerians and the Gurdjieffians, they're always more royal than the king. You know, they're more Steinerian than Steiner himself. And I think Jung resisted the idea of a Jung Institute until, you know, fairly late in his life. And it was on the insistence of people like Marie-Louise von Franz and others that it started. So I think, you know, they are aware of the problems of, say, you know, kind of what you might call the guru complex. You know, they're aware of those problems. At the same time, you know, they give in to them at times, too. I mean, I'm sure Jung enjoyed, you know, having people around him, mostly women,
who,
you know, sort of really appreciated, you know, every word he had to say, and then so on and so on. So,
well, what's your take on Jung today, or the Jungians today, or Jungianism, or however you want to do it? I mean, both Maja and I have done talks at the Pacifica University, which is, you know, devoted to Jung, and there's a strange quality about it. Even though, unlike anthroposophy, they're not explicitly spiritual, it does have this sort of, well, cult or sect like quality to it. And I'm trying to figure out, is that a fault in Jung? Is it an inevitable outcome of how these sort of charismatic figures make a mark on history? How do you see that dynamic today?
Well, I think what happens is that these people, you know, they're fantastically creative and they generate a huge body of ideas, and there's certainly enough there to keep a lot of other people going for a long time. And I think this gets back to what I briefly touched on at the end before we went to a break, this idea of sort of bringing, like, the two sides, you know, the whatever you want to call it, the alternative and the mainstream together, making them part of the same conversation, rather than what seems to happen is that you get, it's almost like they're like sort of like spiritual ghettos, you know, in a way. You kind of get like, okay, you, and especially nowadays with the internet and the whole sort of vast network of communication, these sort of, you know, a multiplicity of different sort of subcultures can exist. You know, there isn't, you know, there's no news about this, but there isn't one counterculture anymore. There's, you know, dozens of different sort of subcultures, and so you can get a community that's what they live in, the Jung world, or they live in the Steiner world, or they live in the Gurdjieff world, and it's opposed to the, you know, the outside world, the everyday world that we all have to sort of move through. You know, and this is I don't know. I mean, I think in many ways it's inevitable, because the people that they're following, they were so, you know, prodigious. They produced enough to sort of create a whole world around them. But I don't think Jung wanted that. I think certainly Steiner, in his last days, he actually lamented the fact that things like the Steiner education and biodynamic farming and the sort of anthroposophical medicine, that they were kind of becoming these sorts of movements on their own, and he felt they were moving away from the essence of, you know, his teaching about consciousness and thought and so on and so on. But I think this is, to me, it's understandable, but it's one of the problems is that these figures are able, mostly after their death, to create a kind of sub-world that others can sort of live in, and it's an alternative world. Whereas I think what they really want, and I think this is what Jung wanted when he insisted that he was a scientist, they want to be part of the general conversation of things that have been going on since day one. You know what I mean? They don't want to have to be a nice little, you know, pocket side thing. You go there and then you don't have to deal with, you know, the rest of the world. You can live inside that world.
I mean, I want to ask you a question about, because you also wanted this to be part of a larger conversation, and I'm curious, how's it going? How do you see it happening?
That's a good question.
We're talking. So I don't know. I think there's still a great deal of resistance to trying to, you know, sort of bring in these sorts of ideas into the mainstream talk. I'm on radio here in London. I write for newspapers, but you still have to sort of couch these things in a slightly kind of ironic or slightly kind of, you know, questionable way to get them sort of in. So I don't know. I mean, I like to think over time. What I'm struggling to find a word to use, alternative movement, whatever you want to call it. I think over time, this will gradually sort of seep in, and it'll become part of the sort of general vocabulary. But you know, maybe not in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's a real slow process. I mean, I mean, that's part of the reasons I really like your approach, is because I also very much feel in sympathy with your mission. But I have to say that over the years that I've been, you know, trying to do it in my own way, it's formidable. The resistances are really quite significant inside the academy, inside mainstream media, among scientists. And I actually stopped, I kind of gave up writing. For a while I would write journalistic articles where I would go in and like look at a subculture and often they were mystical or bizarre in some ways. And even though I would still, you know, make the requisite jokes, which were funny and we all deserve to be laughed at points, I took this stuff very seriously. And there was a certain point where I realized that it wasn't really clear that I was pleasing anybody, because the groups would be irritated that I wasn't doctrinaire on their side. Right. And then everyone else would be like, these secularists would say, why are we paying attention to this? I wrote a big article about Amici, the hugging saint.
Yeah.
And I bent over backwards to kind of, not justify it, but explain it from the perspective that a secular person could accept.
Yeah.
It was like, look, who cares? She's hugging people and you know, building hospitals in India. Who cares? And it was astounding, the amount of hateful, you know, new atheist kind of feedback that it got. And it was like, wow, this is just not that easy.
I find I get it from both sides. I mean, I find you trawl through the net and you see, oh, you're on some cult site, and, you know, they're calling you a follower, a devotee of whoever, you know, and then you, on another site that is the cult that you're supposed to be a member of, they're complaining that you're critical. This is something, again, I think that goes back to Jung, whereas I think Jung finally realized that he wasn't going to be sort of accepted by the mainstream intellectual community, and it was sort of the grassroots, you know, common people that were going to read his books and benefit by them. And I think that's still the case now. I think, you know, I mean, in one way, who cares if the people in academia, you know, change their minds about these sorts of things. I think what's important is in people's lives, you know, and if people in their everyday lives are informed by some of these things that we are all concerned with and try to, you know, promote, then I think gradually it'll make a change. I mean, I'm a firm believer in the cumulative effect of little acts of intelligence, and over time, you know, they'll amount to something, you know.
I hope that's
my faith, you know, put it that way. So
one of my favorite quotes, like you said, Jung did it for the common people. There was that quote that he said that a woman told him, just one of his clients, that his books were like bread to her.
I think that's what it's about. There's a sort of movement here. The fellow Sonu Shamdasani, who edited the Red Book, and he's the one responsible for it coming out. There's a movement. He's associated with the Wellcome Institute here in London, and there's a movement there to try and reaffirm Jung's scientific standing. They kind of want to, he was a scientist, and they kind of want to push to one side the mystical aspects, and that was one reason why I did the book. I think, like, well, come on, you know, the horses have bolted from the barn long ago, and, you know, there's not much you can do. But at the same time, I think.